Hello, I'm Matt Baume, and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. We're on a podcast search for the entertainment that's changed the lives of queer people. On tonight's episode, Dolly Parton and fairy tales. My guest this week is Tripp Gailey, who grew up in the macho world of rodeo before leaving it all behind to join the world of fairies. At his first opportunity, Tripp left home to study literature and Shakespeare, finding himself drawn to classical fantasies, to the point that he reshaped his life around them, finding a home in England and dedicating himself to the study of magical tales. Now, his first novel is about to debut. It's entitled A Market of Dreams and Destiny, and it's about a human teen who sees an opportunity to escape the oppressive world of his childhood for one of freedom, magic, and romance with the mysterious man. We'll have that conversation in a minute, but first, you may have heard that I, too, have a new book out. It's about the behind-the-scenes history of queer characters on sitcoms and the role that comedy played in queer liberation, and continues to play to this day. It's called Hi Honey, I'm Homo, and it's available now wherever books are sold. I can even sign and personalize your copy before shipping it out to you. Just go to gaysitcoms.com and look for the instructions for ordering a signed copy. Also, if you're a fan of queer culture, and I'm sure you are, don't forget to swing by my YouTube channel for my videos about film and TV history. That's at youtube.com/mattbaume. I've got one coming soon about the behind-the-scenes making of All in the Family. And join me every Sunday for live streams over on Twitch at twitch.tv/mattbaume, where I share the amazing bits of film and TV history that I come across in my research. Also, big thanks to everybody who makes my work possible on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/mattbaume to support The Sewers of Paris and get patron-exclusive benefits. Now, here's my conversation with Tripp. Well, this week I'm speaking with Tripp Gailey, author of the forthcoming novel, A Market of Dreams and Destiny. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
So we're going to have to start with Dolly Parton.
Great.
Yeah. Like hands down, earliest memory of being aware of any kind of pop culture, anything. And it is Dolly Parton.
How did she come to you?
I honestly have no idea. It is that far back, and it is that sort of like archetypal and like bound up in my childhood. But I grew up on a cattle ranch. My parents are professional rodeo athletes, so country music was just there in the background all the time. And I don't know how or why I got tuned in to Dolly Parton, but I clearly did, because one of my earliest memories is I had to have been four at the oldest. And I remember taking my dad's neckerchiefs and using them to make a dress and a wig, and finding my mom's microphone that she used to announce at rodeos, and lip syncing to Dolly Parton in very, very basic improvised four-year-old drag. Just around the house.
That must have been quite a sight. And I am so curious about how your parents reacted to that.
They thought it was funny. Like, I'm not clear why they thought it was quite so humorous, but they did. They thought it was hilarious. And I don't know if it happened before this moment or after this moment, but for Christmas, they got me a Dolly Parton pinup photo book. It was called Dolly Close Up, Dolly Close Up. Dolly Up Close, Dolly Close Up, something like that. So from a very young age, they were very supportive of me liking Dolly Parton. I don't know if they thought that was because I would be like a ladies' man or something, but yeah, Dolly Parton and the utter fabulousness and the artifice and just how like kind and bright her energy was, yeah, drew me like a moth to a flame. And I do not know why, but it is a foundational law of my queerness that Dolly Parton was there from the beginning.
There must have been a lot of very macho or at least heterosexual energy in the world, I would imagine, of like rodeo stuff. But it's so interesting that that Dolly is, I don't know, I guess something that transcends that. It you know, because clearly, like, you found something really welcoming and I guess inclusive about her.
Yeah, it's very strange, because it's a very, very rigid gender binary sort of environment. It is very incredibly masculine. But I guess that's why Dolly Parton stands out so much, because she's so incredibly feminine. Mm-hmm. There was something like the rhinestones and the artifice and the over the topness. It's not something you saw in everyday life. It was more than real. And like, yeah, the traditional masculinity of rodeo is very gritty and grimy and grungy. And at the same time, it's a bit over the top as well. Like, I mean, I have a pair of monogrammed green leather chaps with white fringe. And like, if that is not one of the gayest things I have ever heard, I don't know what is. But it's just seen as just a standard part of this incredibly masculine sort of world.
There's an aspect of what you're describing that sounds like drag on the part of Dolly, but also kind of a form of drag for the people who are doing rodeo. Can you describe like that world for folks who aren't familiar? Like what is that? In the same way that like a heterosexual person might be like, what happens in a drag bar? What happens at a rodeo and in the world that you were in?
It's sports. It is sports, but it is sports with horses, in a very, very American way. Like I've also done equestrian, which is sports with a horse, but in a very sort of like European way. They're very different. But like rodeo is like it grew out of the skills that you would need to handle cattle on the range back in the day. So there's a lot of roping and riding and jumping and racing and all sorts of things.
Well, what was like the expectation for you? Like, were you a part of the all the rodeo stuff?
Yes. There are often children's events at rodeo, which are oh so incredibly dangerous. And I don't know how many of them are still around. But I'm sure most people are familiar with the idea of like a bucking bronco, right? You know, a man gets on a horse and they cinch the horse so it's very uncomfortable, and as soon as it goes out of the gate it starts bucking trying to throw the man off, and it is wild, and like lasting 8 seconds is considered really really good and what you need to do just to qualify for to place in rodeo. And they have a version of that for kids called mutton bustin', where they do the same sort of thing but with a sheep. So they put, you know, small children on a sheep that is trying to throw them off. And it's sort of like the kids' version of the adult event. So there's mutton bust in the calf scramble where you're running around after calves trying to like yank a ribbon off the calf's tail. Blood is not uncommon. Yeah, so there's children's version of the events as well. I've gone off on a complete tangent. I don't remember the original question. I'm sorry. I'm just
So
no,
what
I was
was
not expecting to go down this route.
did you were you were you into this life or were you like enthusiastic for it?
I was so not into this life. I was not into this life at all. I was the kid with with his nose in a book. I was the stereotypical like sensitive child that like the parents don't quite know what to do with. Like I could do it. And I did it, but I did not enjoy it. I was much more comfortable being off away with the fairies. I was much happier with my nose in a book. There was a lot of yelling and like trying to yank my nose out of that book and put me back up on the horse. But yeah, I never really clicked with that life. It's very, it makes for great stories, fantastic stories. But yeah, I never fit.
What were the books that you were into?
So fairy tales to begin with. Absolutely obsessed with fairy tales. Fantasy books of all kinds. When I got a bit older, the standard sort of going through The Hobbit and C.S. Lewis, through to classics like David Eddings' Belgariad and those sorts of things. And this was back before you had a queer presence in fantasy. I didn't really see myself reflected in that literature very much, so I resonated with it very strongly because fantasy has a strong thread of the other in it, and I very much resonated with the other. I loved fairy tales. I loved things that were magical and impossible. Possibly a little bit because one of my very early memories is because I had my nose buried in a book all the time. I clearly remember my parents frequently joking when I was a child that I must have been switched at birth at the hospital. There must have been a mix-up. I must have been switched at birth for someone else's kid. And then obviously in fairy tales, you have the idea of the changeling, like, you know, the fairy child that's brought in and left, and the human child goes away to the fairy world. And I very much felt like the unfortunate fairy child that got left behind and didn't fit in the world where I'd been left.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, were there characters that you felt particularly close to?
I felt particularly close to the character of Garion in David Eddings' Dalgariad and Malorian series. I think because David Eddings did the classic thing. He went with a farm boy, and I grew up on a ranch, which is very, very similar. So it really resonated with me to have this character who grew up on a ranch and then went off and had this amazing magical adventure. Of course, every time he complained about wanting to go back to the farm where it was safe and simple and he had all his memories and his friends, I was like, "You're insane. Why would you ever want to go back there?" But having that shared experience of being like, "Oh no, I know exactly how this works. I know exactly how to fix a wagon because I've had to help my parents fix a wagon," and having those sort of shared experiences, yeah, it really resonated with me.
Did you create your own like fantasy? Were you writing at that point?
I was not really writing at that point. I was just soaking in so much in reading. And it was before, like, I lived in the middle of nowhere, like, absolute middle of nowhere. I did not have access to regular television until I was 16. So I was very much raised out of time. My pop culture knowledge is either really, really good, but 20 years out of date for the age that I am, or incredibly spotty. The only reason I have such an in-depth and insane knowledge of 80s cartoons is because my great aunt, who was obsessed with soap operas to the point where she learned how to program her VCR, would program her VCR on Saturday mornings to record me cartoons and then drive them out to me
Wow.
Saturday afternoon so that I could watch them on a VCR that I had to buy myself, that I had to save up and buy myself.
Wow. So I was going to ask, like, if you felt the isolation, like, if you were aware that you were kind of cut off from some larger culture, but it sounds like if you were saving up to buy a VCR, you definitely were aware that there was more stuff out there.
I both was and I both wasn't. And that's like that's one thing about like being gay in that environment. You know something's different, but you don't know what it is. And there are so few people, and myself in particular, because I grew up on the rodeo circuit, I didn't start interacting with other kids my age very much at all, except for the kids that were on the rodeo circle, of which there were two. I had like two friends until I was like six, at which point I had to start school. So you didn't even have like kids repeating what their parents were saying. So like you didn't see gay people. Like I didn't even hear a whisper of the word gay or the word queer until I was 9 or 10. It wasn't something that came up, and it like there was no like there was a sense, very much a sense that I was different, that I was other. But like the idea of what sort of other I might be, no clue. And obviously at that young of age, there's some sort of attraction here and there, but it's like you haven't really hit the strong sexual attraction of puberty. So like that clue wasn't there either. Yeah, I was very much like isolated, and I was vaguely nebulously aware that there was more stuff out there because I occasionally like let's say at my grandparents had a television, so I could see that there was more out there and that the world was bigger. But like those sort of like interpersonal connections and social connections that sort of feed you information almost by osmosis weren't really there or very really sketchily there. So yeah, definitely cut off in very strange ways.
What sort of awareness did you have of anything gay or queer?
The first time I remember the word queer, I was at some relative's house, and I remember they mentioned saying, "Oh, that dog is so queer." The dog was just running around, like humping everything in sight. And I had no context for it, but I definitely remember like the way the word was said for some reason, like stuck in my head. And then eventually it had to like, come up as like gay had to come up as an insult in school at some point. But I wasn't like in school, I wasn't ever really called gay. I was occasionally called girly, and I was frequently called nerdy. But gay wasn't really like thrown around as an insult. I think because there weren't that many gay people, and there weren't that many gay people on television at that point even. So I
Sure.
think it just didn't come up a lot. I definitely know that I had generally figured out what queerness was by the age of 12, because at the age of 12, we got a new house, and the bulletin boards came in.
Oh, like online.
Online bulletin boards, yes, precursor to the internet. By the time I was like 14 or so, we finally got AOL, ding, 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 buzz, AOL. And I found my way into chat rooms. And in chat rooms, I discovered, like, oh, this is what gay is. And then, of course, you have the internet. So obviously, porn eventually starts filtering in. And somewhere in there, someone mentioned a fantasy novel that had gay characters. And I was like, wait, what? You can have that? And it took me forever to track it down. It was The Last Herald Mage by Mercedes Lackey.
Oh, sure. Can you describe Mercedes Lackey for folks who aren't familiar with her work?
Mercedes Lackey is a writer, and she has written so many books. But The Last Herald Mage was late 80s, early 90s. It's a secondary world fantasy about a country that has people with psychic powers as well as magical powers. And The Last Herald Mage is the story of Vanyol, who is gay and is so incredibly traumatized. Like, that trilogy is so very traumatic. And I read it far too young, but it was the first time I remember seeing there is a gay person in a fantasy novel, and that was just mind-blowing.
Was it something you could share with other people in your life, or did you have to keep it secret?
Oh no. Oh no. This was very much a keep yourself secret to keep yourself safe situation. I will not go into detail, but my home life was not a safe one growing up. I was not able to be even uncomfortably out until I made it to university. I managed to have some utterly ridiculous porn level absurd teenage encounters, Hayloft sort of things. But it was not the sort of thing that was ever spoken of. It was never in the context of boyfriends. It was just very much in the context of exploration. And it was not until I got to university that I even managed to sort of vaguely stumble uncomfortably half in and out of the closet.
What was that? Well, I guess first of all, like, what was your, university experience? Like, where did you go and what were you looking for?
So I knew I wanted to go to university as far away as I possibly could, but at the same time, going far away to university was not something that anyone did. I believe of my graduating class, there are only two of us that went to university outside of the state. And the other person that went outside of the state literally went one state up because she had grandparents in a city up there. But people went to, if they went to university at all, less than 50% of my graduating class even went to university. If they went to university at all, they went in state to a state university. There was just no support from the guidance counselors in terms of what options there were or how to plan for that sort of life. The guidance counselor basically was like, here's your ACT packet, go study, go take the test. We'll help you write an essay if you need to. So I had this general idea that, like, Oxford was a really good university. I knew that, because there wasn't because it was enough in, like, sort of public consciousness that that was a name I knew, I recognized. I knew it was in England, and I because of Tolkien, because of the amazing books by Susan Cooper, which hit me like a bolt of lightning when I was probably 10. I was fascinated with England, with the United Kingdom. And I was like, oh, Oxford's over there. Maybe I'll apply to Oxford, not knowing at all how difficult it would be to get into Oxford.
Sure, yeah.
If you don't know how difficult something is, fine, whatever. And I did not go to Oxford. Spoiler alert. that is not where I ended up. But I did well enough on my standardized tests that I started getting mail from universities. And one of these was a massive, glossy, blue cover brochure for Yale. And if you know what Yale looks like, it looks it's a neo-Gothic fantasy land. Like, these
Oh, sure,
buildings
yeah.
are stunning and beautiful, and everything's green. And it looks, by design, like Oxford and Cambridge. Like, it's a complete deliberate aping of Oxford and Cambridge. So I saw it and I was like, well, this looks great. Because at that point, I already knew that I wasn't going to be able to apply to Oxford, not because I didn't think I could get in, because I was still like completely oblivious to just how hard that would have been, but because my parents had told me, you're not allowed to leave the country the first year away from home. Like, that was a hard limit. So I was like, fine. Well, where's Yale? Oh, look, it's literally as far as you can go towards England before an ocean gets in the way.
Sure. Yeah. So did you, what was your like field of study, or like, what were you going to do there aside from like being as close to England as you could be?
I had no idea. I had no idea. Like I said, my parents, they own a ranch. They have never had traditional employment. They did not have friends who were in traditional employment. I grew up with zero context of what it would be like to think about a career, plan a career, to know what you wanted to do. I had no context for that. So I was like, going to university was what you did. So that's what I did. I applied to university, and mainly just to escape, to get out of this world that I did not fit and I was not comfortable in.
I imagine there must have been a bit of a culture clash when you finally arrived in Connecticut.
Everyone always says that, but I was so happy to be there. I'm sure I did not fit the Connecticut culture or the Yale collegiate culture, but I was so enthused and I was so free from those weights that I just dived right in.
What made you happy about it?
The biggest thing, obviously, was that I was free to explore myself for the first time ever. Literally, the first, like, my parents drove me out, which was fascinating 2 days stuck in a van with my parents. And they attended some of the orientation things. They went to the dean's luncheon or afternoon tea, whatever it was. And I remember waiting all of 5 minutes before I also left the dean's luncheon or whatever it was. And I went to the nearest hairdressers and I bleached my hair white.
Oh, okay. So you're not wasting any time. It sounds like you're like,
no,
I'm going to be
literally,
a new...
I was still in my like nice blazer and slacks and everything. I literally just left and like went straight to the hairdressers. And I was like, bleach my hair white. Just please, just bleach it. Just do
it. Did you have a picture in your mind of who you wanted to be once you were there?
No, absolutely. Just no picture. I just...
Why did you start with the hair?
It's one of those things, like a small act of rebellion. Growing up in a small rural area, there are very clear rules that are communicated to you, things that are allowable, things that are not. Tattoos are not allowed. Piercings are not allowed. Non-standard hair color, not allowed. At the time, I was terrified of needles, so piercings and tattoos were out, but I was not afraid of a bit of bleach. So... changing my hair seemed to be the obvious first. I am not there. I am not one of those people. I'm one of the people that like has funky hair color and stuff.
What did that do for
you? I will do that. It made me one of the two most recognizable people on campus, which was very bemusing. But I just like, it was affirming. It was amazing. It's one of the first things I did that just sort of asserted, look, this is me, and I am not part of this culture that I grew out of. This is me exercising my free will upon my person to self-fashion myself into something closer to what I want to be. I didn't know what it was, but stumbling around, I was like, yeah, no, this, I like this.
what other stuff did you experiment with that was useful, that like was, you know, revealed to you, this is who I am?
I tried a lot of different things. That's one of the great things about Yale as a university, is it is incredibly supportive of a huge variety of schools and clubs and different things. And at least when I went, it was very, very queer friendly. I didn't realize it when I applied, but Yale is often called the gay Ivy. And that came about because in, I think it was like 1987 or something, some graduate wrote an outraged opinion think piece at some paper on the Eastern Seaboard about, it's ridiculous that of Yale's 10,000 students, nearly 1 in 4 identify as gay. And the statistic came from nowhere. This person was just outraged and published this thing. But ever since then, Yale's been known as the gay Ivy, and it was very gay friendly. They had a very strong LGBTQ plus society that ran dances for queer students. And it was just like, you felt, or at least I did, much safer being gay. It obviously took me a while to come to terms with that, because I had spent the last 19 years in an environment where it was 100% not safe. So even there where it was safe, it took me a while to be like, are we sure this is okay? But eventually I did, and I dyed my hair and I started kissing boys and just having a grand old time. But I like threw myself into band and drama, and I even took part in, there's a campus organization of students who play the bells in the carillon in Harkness Tower. So I learned to play the bells in the carillon. I was terrible at it, but I did it. Mm-hmm. And just trying all of these things and eventually slotting right into the geeks. I started playing Dungeons and Dragons and going to science fiction and fantasy conventions and fighting other students with foam swords on Saturdays on the green and the quad. And it's kind of like when I went to university, I had the option to discover myself fully, both as a geek and as a queer person. And I fell into the geek side of it much more easily than I fell into the queer side of it. I didn't really fall into the queer side of it until after I graduated university and came here to the UK for the first time. I did a master's degree in Shakespeare, which I only knew about because my last boyfriend at university had told me about it. He was British, doing his doctoral studies over there. And I was like, oh, and then I came here to the UK, and something about being here in the UK finally lifted whatever last weight was holding me back, and I really fell into embracing my queerness here in the UK.
It sounds like you kind of had sort of a practice England with old campus at Yale, and so finally, once you made it across the ocean, like, did that feel like that moment in a fantasy novel where you go through the wardrobe or you cross the stone wall or whatever, and you're finally in that land?
Yeah, it 100% did. Everything over here was so green, like so incredibly green. Like Yale was green, but it was New England green, and it would turn to like fall colors, and then you would get snow and everything would be white. But I came over here to England in the fall and everything was still so green. I'm like, it should have really been turning gray or brown or to a riot of fall colors, but it wasn't. It was just still so green. And I caught a train, and British trains are very different from American trains. And you sit at that table and you look out that window at the countryside rolling by. And yeah, there was something about it that was just magic. And the sense of freedom that came with it, of finally having an ocean between me and all of the stuff from my childhood that didn't fit and felt constraining. Yeah, it was amazing.
So you came over to do a master's in Shakespeare? What exactly, like where, and what was the goal there?
I still didn't know what I wanted to do. I had a degree. I did a double degree at Yale in both English and theater because I knew I liked those things and I enjoyed those things. But those are not directly applicable things to many job situations. So I was like, I'll go do further studies. I'll keep being a student. I knew I liked being a student. I knew I loved studying. I'm like, I'll push it off for one more year. And then I pushed it off for another year and went and got another degree before I finally entered the job market of the real world. But I wanted to live in England. I wanted to study Shakespeare. I was still obsessed with fairies. I did my studies on how non-human characters in Shakespeare were created for the stage, looking specifically at A Midsummer Night's Dream and The Tempest.
Do you
So
have a favorite fairy?
studying, I'm a big fan of Puck, and that's sort of the easy, obvious choice. At different points, I've also loved like Oberon and Titania in different incarnations. They were fantastic, for example, in Disney's Gargoyles. I don't know if you've seen that or familiar with that. But there is something subversive and anarchic about Puck that really increasingly appealed to and still increasingly appeals to me today, especially with the way the world is and how important it feels to rebel against tyrannical, constrictive systems and cultures that are trying to shove gay people back into the closet and take away trans rights and just grind out anything that isn't conformist or normal, air quotes, normal. So, yeah, the sense of that rebelliousness and anarchy that Puck brings, it's hard for him not to be one of my favorites.
Was there a point in there where you started writing your own stuff?
So I began writing. You know what? I tell a lie. I did start writing as a child. I completely forgot. I was obsessed with the Boxcar Children books as a child.
Oh, sure,
And
yeah.
in third grade, the teacher kept a stack of blank books in the classroom just for kids to draw on or whatnot. And actually, in third grade, I started, air quotes, writing my own Boxcar Children novels. So very, very early fanfic. Back before I even knew fanfic was a thing. I guess I started writing my own stories in third grade. And my family, like for all of my complicated relationships with my family are a family of storytellers. Like my dad and my uncles and my aunt can sit around the Thanksgiving table or the Christmas table and absolutely just pull out these ripping yarns and tell them so entertainingly. So storytelling was always a very like strong part of my life, but I didn't seriously begin writing until I was at university. There was a course on writing science fiction and fantasy at Yale taught by John Crowley, and I took that, and then I took screenwriting courses, and I wrote off and on. I ran so much Dungeons and Dragons. I ran a ton of Changeling the Lost. I did a lot of storytelling in that role-playing game mode. And then after I finished schooling and I went back to New York City for a while because my visa ran out, sad. In like 2008, 2009, I wrote my first absolutely terrible, which no one will ever see, novel. And then basically was convinced by society and everyone that I had to like, get a real person job. So I worked in copywriting and marketing because I could write. And that was a business application of those skills. And I did that for 10 years. And I would write things here and there, short stories and scripts and things. But it was always sort of to the side. It was my brain trying to put the creativity somewhere because it didn't really have an outlet and it was clearly desperately needed, but I didn't have the mental energy to truly pursue it. because so much of my mental energy was spent at work and adulting and making money and things, and I didn't have that extra bandwidth to really consider pursuing it to an intense degree.
Mm-hmm. What changed there? Because you've got a book coming out, so how did that happen?
The 2016 election happened, is mm-hmm. what happened. At that point in time, I had somehow been roped into a managerial role, much to my surprise. But I had a salary, I had a job with crushing hours. The 2016 election happened, and it was like, no, I can't stay here in this country and watch this happen. It doesn't feel safe. I'm already drastically unhappy. And then the company I was working for at the same time went bankrupt. At that point, I was very much, this is a sign from the universe. Time to go back to England. Mm-hmm. Time to go back to what I'm good at and what I have been wanting to do for a long time. So I applied for a doctoral study program in creative writing because I knew I could get the student visa, I could go back to the UK, I could be back in the place where I felt queer and safe and just much more alive for at least 4 years. And at that point, I was like, that was as far into the future as I could see. It was 4 years into the future. I'm like, fine, let's do this. We can do this. So my husband was amazing. He's like, yes, no, you're totally doing this. So I applied and I got in and I moved back over here. And that was 6 years ago. And over the course of my doctoral studies, again, studying fairies, I was specifically looking at the fantasy trope of the goblin market.
Mm-hmm.
As part of my doctoral studies, but I also wrote a book as part of my doctoral studies. And that is the book that will be out in September. And I fell into it, and I, for the first time in my life, I had no distractions. I had my PhD. I had a source of funding. I didn't have to worry about anything except just studying writing and writing nonstop and falling into and falling in love with the science fiction and fantasy book and convention culture here in the United Kingdom. And it's so remarkable. It's the perfect size to have diversity, but also be welcoming and just fun. And you know enough people at pretty much any event that you go to once you've been going for a little while that, yeah, it just clicked and it was natural and it was great. And I finished my book and my PhD and I sent it off, and I was very, very fortunate that within 6 months of finishing my PhD and my book, I had an agent and a book deal.
Sounds like a real rapid transformation.
Yeah, it was like everything had just been, I guess everything had just been building up in the background over the past 10 years before I decided to just go for it. And when I finally had the chance to let it loose, it just let loose, and boom, here we are.
So tell me about the book. What is it about? What did you actually let loose into it?
It was interesting because I love fairy tales. I love fairies. I love goblin markets and the idea of being able to affect with a trade a change to an intangible or immaterial part of your being. I love stories where someone trades away their shadow for 7 years of good luck, things like that. Absolutely fascinated. So, of course, I'm like, oh, I'll study that. And so to study that, I did a thing called practice-based research. And so if I'm studying how these kinds of stories work, one way to study that is to write one of these stories myself. And so I built the book around the goblin market, the fairy market that you can go to and trade anything for anything. And then I brought with it just so much of my own experience. Even now, we have some fantastic representation in science fiction fantasy. We have some really great queer fantasy novels out there. But there's not a lot of it. And I'm like, well, I want to write my sort of queer fantasy. So I made sure that I had a gay male protagonist, or at least a protagonist, a male protagonist who has sex with other men. And I made sure to include a queer love story and a lot of queer characters in the background, and to bring that sense of heightened reality that I had been enamored with ever since I was a small child, like Dolly Parton, that sense of larger than life, that sense of drag to things. I even approached my pen name as a drag name, just so I just tried to pack this book with all the stuff that I loved and I found super engaging. So you've got London, because I adore London. I feel so incredibly privileged to live here now. So I put in London, and I put in the gay history of London, and I put in or the queer history of London. I put in a gay love story. I put in my obsession with fairies and a lot of the heightened artifice and reality to these fey creatures, making them larger in life in a way that Dolly Parton is larger than life, in a way that drag queens are larger than life. All of those things just crammed in as thickly and densely as possible to the book.
So how does it feel to have that finally not just coming out of you and like going into a book, but about to be in front of people?
It is incredibly surreal. It's so strange, and it hits in waves and in ways you don't expect. I'm very much someone who doesn't believe something until it's in black and white in front of me. So, like, I got the offer, from an agent and from a publisher, and it didn't seem real until I had the signed contract. And then it still didn't feel quite real. And I got the first advance review copy of my book. And I'm like, I'm holding this book in my hand, and it still doesn't feel quite real. And then I opened it to the first page, and I read the first paragraph, like the words that I had wrote in actual physical form in a book I was holding. And it was overwhelming. It was magic. And it's still magic because now I have the real copies, and I've picked up some of the swag that the publishers are putting out. Like, I just, like, literally yesterday, I went to the head offices and I picked up pin badges, specially designed pin badges that they've done to send out with the review copies. And there's planning for a launch party and all of these things. And it's just waves. It's all of these new experiences that I've heard about and thought about. And like, one happens, and it's still surprising every single time something happens. And I don't know if it'll ever wear off or when it will wear off, but it's still like, it's a constant surprise to me that this is occurring.
Does having all this stuff coming out and living this life now where you have the fantasy that you always wanted to tell and you're able to create a world and bring people into it, does it feel a bit like you are now living inside the kind of fantasy that you could only dream about when you were younger?
Yes, like there are, it's such a very, very surreal existence right now, because it is, it's a lot of work, and there's a lot of there's a lot of like complication and disappointment, and obviously publishing is a brutal business that does not pay very well. But there are these amazing, fantastical moments. And yeah, if you reached back through time, through an enchanted mirror, so that I could talk with that younger version of myself, and tell him that one day he would be writing and publishing the sorts of books that he loves so much, and he'd be doing it in a place that he thought of as so magical, with people who he loves and are absolutely amazing. Like, it would feel like a fairy tale to him. Like, it's not a huge flat, but it's a nice flat. in London. I live in, we call it the Writer Flat. It's full of queer men who write. That's literally every one of us who lives here is a queer man who writes. And we have such just like a fantastic dynamic, a fantastic vibe. Like we all cook for one another and we have great conversations. And a lot of us are working together on projects, like group projects. And if you have a problem, you can just pop your head into the kitchen or one of the offices and be like, oh, let's talk about sword and sorcery for 15 minutes because I've got this thing that I'm trying to do. And we've just started literally just a few days ago. We incorporated a queer small press that's going to specialize in science fiction and fantasy. And it's a dream come true. Oh, the small press is called Bona Books. The name comes from Polari. But yeah, it is like a fairy tale come true in a lot of ways. It's a beautiful and it's amazing, and it's no less so for the fact that we still have to pay the gas bill and make sure the flat joint account has rent money in it every month.
Sure, but it sounds like you're not just writing for yourself, but you're kind of creating a kind of a market, or you're creating this sort of like building up a world with other people who have come together like you, and you found your people.
I have 100% found my people. Found family is an amazing thing, an amazing queer privilege, and I love it and I'm so thankful for it all the time. Very, very happy with my found family in this country. Yeah, it's great.
So if folks want to check out your book, where should they go?
So the easiest way in the massively splintered internet realm that we live in is Linktree. So linktr.ee/tripgaily. That's TRIPGALEY.
Perfect. And the book comes out in September, right?
Yep, A Market of Dreams and Destiny will be out 12th September.
Fantastic. Well, congratulations on the book, and thanks so much for chatting with me.
Thank you.
Thanks to Trip for joining me. Thanks to you for listening. And thanks to everybody who makes the Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to support the podcast and get back rewards like weekly bonus videos and a care pack in the mail. Check out my new book, Hi Honey, I'm Homo, for a history of queer characters on American sitcoms. Visit my YouTube channel for stories from behind the scenes of iconic pop culture and keep up with even more of my work through my weekly newsletter. You can find all that and more at mattbaum.com. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of Comptech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.